The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
When did you first hear about Thomas Francis Marr?
Well, I'm ashamed to admit that as an Irish American, I had never heard of a person who was arguably the most famous Irish American until John F. Kennedy came along. So I really didn't hear about him until I saw the statue in Helena, Montana State Capitol, and the then governor, Brian Schweitzer, pointed, and I said, "Who's the guy on the horse?" And he said, "You call yourself an Irishman and you don't know who Thomas Francis Marr is." And in fact, I didn't. So I've been trying to fill in my ignorance ever since.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Seattle author Timothy Egan about his latest book, The Immortal Irishman, The Irish Revolutionary Who Became an American Hero. There's been trouble in Ireland for hundreds and hundreds of years, and it seems like it all started in 1155 with Pope Adrian IV. He sent a letter to King Henry II of England. So just explain what was in that letter and what happened after that.
Yeah, I don't want to call it racism, though there were different, clans. There were Celts living in Ireland and Anglo-Saxons living in England. And I don't want to say it was strictly religion, because eventually it broke over Catholicism versus non-Catholics. But there's just always been something between these two where they see the worst traits in each other. And after that letter, the British Empire eventually ruled over 1/4 of the world's landmass. And the most troublesome part of the whole British Empire was this country 30 miles away. They called him ungovernable. And that letter from the Pope, sort of the only English Pope, by the way, so it sort of set the foundation for how these quarrelsome Irish would be treated. They called them a savage race who must be subdued. And they were just considered, clannish and unruly and odd people. And so that they sort of gave it a spiritual foundation. They gave it the print of Rome. This is before they changed religions under the wife killer, Henry VIII. But they gave it this spiritual print that somehow they could go into Ireland and rule these ungodly people.
And so the Pope said what to the king?
I forget what the exact language was of the Pope, but it's one of these sort of long disputed things. But the English used it as a foundation, as a spiritual justification for going into Ireland.
For invading Ireland and
yes.
Subjugating the people and trying to wipe out their entire culture.
Well, they didn't try to wipe out their entire culture then, but it took 700 years, and it was a series of things that now are like a template for apartheid or a template for any, oppressor nation trying to ethnically cleanse another nation, including what the Americans did to the Native Americans here. And Marr himself saw that irony when he was the territorial governor of Montana. But yeah, I mean, that was the foundation, and they eventually, 700 years, a series of awful laws were passed. The worst were probably the penal laws. I mean, at one point, it was a crime to play the harp, which is, that's why it's on the bottle of Guinness. It was the national instrument of Ireland. The English considered it too nationalistic because they would use it for these rebel songs. So Queen Elizabeth actually said, "Hang the harpers wherever they are found." It was a crime to play the favorite Irish sport, which is hurling. So the first thing the Irish did when they settled outside of England, that would be Newfoundland, St. John, which is the first colony of England. They established a hurling club. It was a crime to speak your language. Gaelic was the primary tongue of a majority of Irish, and they outlawed speaking of Gaelic in public. And eventually, they made it a crime to practice your religion, which was the faith of 80% of the natives. And finally, they made it a crime to own property. 80% of the Irish, by the time Thomas Marr was coming of age, did not live on land that they themselves owned. And this was the one I really found peculiar. This is in the penal laws. You could not own a horse if you were a native Irish, worth more than £5 sterling.
So you could own an old nag, but
you can own an old nag. That's right. You can own a terrible horse, a broken down horse. But if that horse was worth more than 5 pounds, that you were breaking the law. And actually, it said you shall be subject to jail time if you own that horse.
So nearly 700 years after the Pope's declaration that made it okay to invade Ireland, Thomas Mar is born, 1823.
Yes, right? Good memory.
And he is born into wealth, really, in Waterford, Ireland, wealth that came from Newfoundland by way of Ireland. Long story we won't go into. But he could have grown up and just had a really cushy life, and he didn't.
You're absolutely right, and that's a great question. He was a prince of Waterford. His family had gone to Newfoundland, as you said. They had made a lot of money in the trade and then come back, and they'd actually repurchased some of the land along the waterfront in Waterford that Cromwell's soldiers had taken from the Irish. Remember, they'd kicked most people off their land and given it to the soldiers. So they were a very wealthy merchant family, and Mar had everything. He had looks, he had education, he had a silk voice. He eventually became the most prominent orator, even in his young 20s in Ireland. He looked like sort of a young Hugh Grant, is the way I saw him. He spoke five languages. He was educated considered the best school in England. I went there, it looks like Downton Abbey. It's just this huge pile. So he comes home and he's 21, 22. He's ready to start his career, maybe go into law, maybe go into politics. And the world is his oyster.
And then what happened?
Well, you're leading the witness here. The Great Famine happens, the worst crime of Ireland, what they call the Great Hunger. In 4 years' time, 1 million Irish die, 1 million Irish. And this is at a time when there's the peak of prosperity in England. And most people know that these people died, or believe these people died, because of the potato blight. And in fact, the Irish were dependent on the potato. And your average Irish peasant family could feed themselves on their 1 acre that they rented from the landlord. And when this thing failed, that meant they didn't have their pantry, essentially. But beyond that, there was lots of food in Ireland at the time of the Great Famine. We know this now through all the scholarship that's come out. The English overlords knew it at the time. They even called it a policy of extermination. So I want to be clear, the English weren't trying to kill the Irish, but they benignly let them die through the famine. More meat was exported from Ireland at the time of the Great Famine than any other part of the British Empire. So you had barley, you had grains and cereal and pork and beef, all shipped off this island while little children are shivering in ditches and their mothers are holding them and people are just dropping dead in mass. 10 times the death toll of the Great Plague of London of 200 years earlier. This radicalizes your future territorial governor, Thomas Francis Mar. He's a nobleman, but he sees this crime. He starts to give these speeches and says, let's close the ports. Why is food leaving Ireland at a time of mass starvation?
So he gave these speeches and people listened, but they couldn't really do anything about it. I mean, they just didn't seem capable, even though they may have wanted to.
Yeah, there were a couple things going on. I may have mentioned that the British had a larger contingent of troops, a larger garrison for most of this time than they ever did even in the subcontinent of India. So all the parts of the British Empire, Ireland was the toughest part to govern. Nominally, they were part of Great Britain. But why would a equal have 20,000 troops? Imagine 20,000 troops in Missoula sitting on the people. And the people themselves had no weapons. I call them pitchfork paddies when they rose up. The second most important thing, and Mar realized this later, the revolution was totally ill-fated. It was a bunch of 20-somethings. Imagine Bernie Sanders supporters taking on, say, the world. But seven of them instead of 700 of them, because it was seven young Ireland leaders, Mar among them. He was the voice of young Ireland. They thought sonnets could defeat swords. They thought poems could beat an empire. They thought words alone could convince the world that the awfulness of this crime of people starving to death. So these pitchfork paddies, all they had were farm implements, and they were starving. And Mar realized that when he would go village to village in advance of what he thought would be a revolution, that all they really wanted was food. I mean, he thought they would come out and cheer him, but they would cheer him with their hands out, and they were scrawny, their skin clinging to their bones. It was an awful, awful thing.
he and several others were eventually arrested and jailed and sentenced to death. They didn't get the sentence that was handed out to them, which was drawing and quartering and scattering their body parts around.
Right. The peculiar way that England disposed of Irish political prisoners in the previous revolution, which is 1798, was they threw the body parts of the rebels into the streets of Dublin after killing them. Mar himself, again, your future territorial governor, was sentenced to be hanged, drawn, and quartered, and his remains disposed of as Her Majesty shall see fit. That was the sentence. He sits in jail for a year, and then Queen Victoria, because there was universal outrage in America and France and elsewhere, civilized quarters of the world, has said, how dare England hang these young men and women. There were women as well. It was a revolution of equals. He will no longer be hanged, drawn, and quartered, but his new sentence is lifetime banishment to the island of Tasmania.
And so he gets to Tasmania, and instead of going to a jail cell, explain what the parameters of his incarceration
were. Yeah, it was a really weird thing because it was the Victorian era, and he was considered a gentleman. This is where the political prisoners were. They were men of some wealth and education. They weren't the starving masses. The starving masses were scattered all over the rest of Australia, which England was trying to make into a penitentiary. And that's how they settled Australia. It was a penal colony. So he gave his word of honor as a gentleman that he would not escape from Her Majesty's island of Tasmania. And because he gave his word of honor, he was allowed to live in a little cabin on a lake.
And he had a 7-mile perimeter.
Yes, it was really funny. He couldn't leave his 7 miles. So the most prominent orator in all of Ireland was reduced to walking in the woods in his 7-mile corridor and talking to his dogs.
And he had a little sailboat and a lake.
Which he named for a poet, Speranza, who was one of his lovers.
But he wasn't happy with that.
He was incredibly lonely. I mean, again, imagine being 26 years old and realizing you're never going to see your home again. You're never going to see Ireland. Being very educated, he spoke 5 languages, having the world ahead of you, and you're living in Mars. I mean, Australia, it took 8-9 months to get there. It was so far off the planet. It was the Southern Hemisphere. It had only been discovered, 30 years earlier. He was the loneliest man in the world. He wrote these letters about his heart just broke because he thought his life was over. So he plotted an escape. And eventually he did escape. It was a thrilling episode. I shouldn't spoil it. Kids give me a bad time for giving away too much of my story. But Thomas Mar, in this second extraordinary epic of his life, has a 12-day escape from the island of Tasmania. It involved sharks and pirates. And he did, as a gentleman, he sent a note to the governor saying, "Dear Honorable Sir, this is to inform you that I, Thomas Francis Mar, shall no longer be a prisoner of the island of Tasmania as of noon tomorrow." And so they sent a dragoon out to pick him up, and he reared up on his horse, and he said, "I'm Thomas Francis Mar. Catch me if you can." he was a great extrovert.
The funniest part of the book was he sends this formal letter.
Right. It's I'm glad you brought that up because I sort of overlooked that part, and people really laugh at that. And now I look at it and it really is funny. And later, some people gave him a bad time in England and in the United States because they said he broke his gentleman's code by escaping. But he considered himself to have kept his gentleman's code because he actually informed them that he planned to escape.
Yes. And then let them chase him. He could have just slunk off into the night.
No, that's what you and I would have done, of course. If you're going to escape, you don't tell them.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Timothy Egan. We're chatting about his latest book, The Immortal Irishman. If you'd like to listen again or share this program with a friend, it's available as a podcast and on demand at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. You'll also find links to it on our Facebook and Twitter pages. We'll be back in just a minute to hear what happened after Thomas Mar landed in New York City. Stay with us. Thank you. when he gets to New York City, evidently people knew he was coming.
Right. Word had gotten out that the Young Tribune, which was one of his nicknames, the greatest orator of Ireland, Thomas Francis Marr, the rebel, had escaped from Tasmania. And this was electrifying news. At the same time, these Irish masses were washing ashore in the United States. It was the first great movement of people from one continent to another. Later, we would see Eastern Europeans, we would see Southern Europeans, Italians, we would see Northern Europeans, Scandinavians, we would see Asians. Of course, African Americans came in chains, but the Irish came because of the Great Famine. 1 million of them died, 1.8 million of them left in what were called coffin ships, because in the early days, only 1 in 5 of them survived the journey. They would die of typhus. And I heard from the Irish Consul General when I was touring that it was an awful thing that these boats would leave with intact families. They would arrive in New York Harbor as orphans, because a lot of times the parents would die on the sail across the Atlantic. They were peasant people. They'd never been more than 30, 40 miles from their little village. So these million plus Irish are washing ashore in Boston, Philly, New York, Baltimore, going south to New Orleans. That's a lot of them came in from New Orleans. And they're saying that Thomas Marr will be the savior. I mean, the way they talk about Jesus, one of the Irish newspapers said, he is the savior who will unite us all. So they're just waiting for the arrival of the great Thomas Marr. And he doesn't know his fate is, you know, that he's supposed to be the savior of the Irish masses.
And at first, he's kind of taken aback by all of this and resists it some. But he eventually went out and did speaking tours and really tried to unite the people. And they were living, at least in New York City, the way you described it, in terrible, squalid conditions. And he urged them to go somewhere else, but they didn't go.
Right. Most of them never came more than a mile or so inland from where they'd landed. And so the Lower East Side of New York had the densest concentration of Irish of anywhere in the world, more than Dublin. And there were gangs, and there were a lot of petty crimes, and they were living in these horrible tenements. The New York City Tenement Museum does a great job of preserving what this is like. You're sleeping on straw on a floor in an old brewery with your family and paying 37 cents a week, and the latrine is somewhere else. Some people slept in stairwells. And Marr's appalled by this condition. I found this description in the New York Times. The elites would sometimes hire an armed guard and go slumming among the poor Irish just to be appalled at these awful conditions. And the New York Times had a quote where they said people would come down for a chance to watch, quote, the pigs and the paddies lie down together. So, I mean, they're living in the horrible conditions in these tenements. They have the jobs that no one else wanted. They're sweeping the manure off the streets. They're building the sewage system. They would build the canals that became Erie Canal. They're taking care of other people's children. They're wiping the snot off the noses of the little kids. They're cleaning the dishes. They're making a living for themselves, but it's horrible. And Marr starts a newspaper. He becomes the most prominent Irish American of his day. There are Marr clubs all over the East Coast. There's a song in his name. There's a polka in his name. I mean, all this from looking at the statue, I didn't realize quite how famous this guy was on three continents. I mean, he did shape history on three continents. But at this point, he does want to assume his destiny. He gives speeches to 5,000-10,000 people, holds these poor Irish immigrants wrapped, and he says, you should get out. You should go west. Then going west was Ohio, and get clean air and find a life for yourself in this country.
But they didn't go just because they stuck together.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And most people don't realize that. The Irish really, that's why when they came to Montana, they only came in Butte. They weren't lone rancher types. They were more clannish. They liked to be with their people. So they did live among themselves. They liked, that's why in the street in the immigrant cities, Philadelphia, Baltimore, they clustered Boston in these immigrant enclaves. And they weren't going to go out and become homesteaders.
Let's see if we can give a condensed version of Marr in the Civil War, because he was very, very involved up to a certain point.
So they run up against the Know-Nothing Party, which was the only political party founded in our history in opposition to a single ethnic group, that being the Irish. They're trying to keep them from becoming citizens, getting civil service jobs. They burn down Irish neighborhoods in Philadelphia. They burn Irish Catholic churches. Marr rises up against the Know-Nothings. But when the Civil War breaks out, people are unsure which way the Irish will go. they're told that, you know, remember, there's 4 million people living in human bondage in the South. And if these blacks are free, they'll come take your terrible jobs. So there's a real conflict. But Marr quickly assumes the mantle of the leader and said, no, of course we'll fight for the Union cause. This is the country that gave us refuge. How could we think otherwise? And it's not about race at that point. It's about fighting for a country that gave them a place to live. And he forms the Irish Brigade. And Lincoln does a brilliant thing. He makes this orator a general. Now, Lincoln did that with certain people who didn't have military experience. It was called a political general. And the big question was whether they would fight or not. I mean, people said the Irish couldn't organize a parade without getting into fisticuffs, let alone going to battle. In fact, they performed brilliantly and with huge sacrifices in all the major conflicts of the Civil War, starting at Bull Run, where the Union Army was routed and arguably that Washington, D.C. could have fallen to the slaveholders because they were just 30 miles away, and the Irish did not run. So that started to make them heroic in the eyes of other people. This is what destroyed the Know Nothing Party. This is what made the Irish citizens, their blood sacrifice for this country. And Marr realized this, said it in a million speeches. That's what made them Americans, was that blood sacrifice. So they performed in all the major battles of the Civil War, Gettysburg, Antietam, which was the bloodiest single day in American history, 23,000 casualties in a single day, 23,000. And the worst of all was Fredericksburg, which was a battle in December of 1862, where the Irish Brigade, there were 1,200 of them waiting to try to take a wall up on a hill. And Marr told them all to put little sprigs of green boxwood in their caps so that when they die, they would know that they died as Irishmen. Then when they turned the bodies over, 1,200 people stormed the hill and only 280 people survived. And it destroyed Marr. Crushed him, absolutely broke his heart. He wept because these were young men whose families he knew, who he had recruited. He'd looked their mothers in the eye, looked their wives in the eye, looked their brothers and sisters in the eye. And so all these people died on his behalf, fighting for the Union cause, fighting for the Irish Brigade, which became one of the most prominent brigades. And to this day, they're well known by historians for their warrior skills, basically.
All that death and the carnage of the Civil War drove Marr west.
Yeah, that's what, you know, what happened was they didn't end up dying for a free Ireland, which they kind of thought they would. He thought after they're done with the slaveholders, they would sail across the Atlantic and kick the British out of Ireland. That never happened. That was one of his recruitment pitches. He realized, as Lincoln did, and he was close to Abraham Lincoln, even though Lincoln was a Republican, Marr was a Democrat, that they had died to free the blacks of America, that that had been their cause. And he got ahead of the other Irish. He even fought them on this, that they should be full citizens. He came all around from being an agnostic on slavery to being someone who saw that that's what that sacrifice had been for. But he's crushed after this, and he's looking to start a new chapter in his life. So he gets an appointment to become the secretary. This is the number two person in Montana Territory. It was then, Idaho was then part of it, and they were just breaking it off. And he comes west to start this another amazing chapter of his life.
And he leaves his wife in New York and travels for 6 months, I think it was, to get to Virginia City, gets off of the stagecoach, and poof.
Yeah, when he arrives in Virginia City, there are corpses dangling from trees. There are drunks rolling down the street. And even though the American flag is flying over the territory of Montana, even though this territory was part of our constitutional democracy, giving people, everyone, a right to a trial, they are summarily executing citizens. And these are the right-thinking people of the territory. These are the merchants, lawyers, prosecutor in one case, Wilbur Sanders, who are Freemasons. They're Protestants. They have these secret meetings, these vigilantes. They're called the Vigilant Committee. And your early history did a terrible job of telling this story. It made these people out to be heroic. In fact, they were murderers. They were executioners. I don't see how you could see them in any other way. There was law in this territory, but they took it into their own hands. And they would decide that a certain person was going to die. In one case, it was a sheriff. They plucked him out of his cabin and strung him up. Another case was pure racism. They plucked a Mexican, they called him, quote, the greaser, strung him up, filled him full of holes, and then burned him to death. And so when Marr arrives in Virginia City, the then governor, Sidney Edgerton, is dressed for travel. And he will get on the very stage that's brought your governor to Montana, and he hands a sheath of papers to Marr and says, here you are, your governor, I'm out of here. And he leaves. The then territorial governor flees. He's not supposed to. And Marr becomes, by default, the acting governor, which he will perform for the rest of his life, which is then 17 months.
His wife comes out, and they live in this little tiny log cabin.
She must have really loved him.
Yes, because she grew up in wealth in New York
City.
Right,
she was a Fifth Avenue beauty who grew up in wealth, exactly.
And Marr died. We would call the circumstances mysterious because they weren't really figured out until maybe the last few years in Montana. So tell us what you found out about how he died.
Yeah. One quick thing on Marr's cabin, which he and his wife called the governor's mansion. It's about 150 square feet. It still exists. I have a picture of it in the book. You can visit it in Virginia City, which is not a ghost town. It still has a pulse. And I recommend it to everyone. We had a wonderful time doing the research. So he's in Fort Benton. In 1867, July 1 is his last day he's ever seen. He's 43 years old. So all of this remarkable journey I've told you about already has been crammed into that short amount of time, which is one of the things that's so amazing about him. He really did live 12 lives in one. He's very popular among Democrats and Irish who've come to Montana. They think it's going to be New Ireland. But he's rubbed up against the vigilantes, and they say terrible things about him. They send notes back to D.C. calling him a drunk and a whoremonger and a this and that, all these awful things. And he writes back saying, these are the worst of my enemies. He pushes back against the vigilantes. He is the governor. So he says, you can't be grabbing people that you've decided are going to die and string them up from what was called the hanging tree in Helena. They had hung one man whom Marr had given a reprieve. And in the back of his pocket, while he's dangling from a tree, there's a picture of this in the book, is Marr's reprieve. They had sent him a note saying, you are next. So he's in Fort Benton on the last day of his life. And this, to this day, is considered one of the greatest, if not the greatest, mystery of Montana. But we know now from most of the stuff that's come out, and I credit Paul Wiley, an attorney in Bozeman, who's written a book about Marr as well. He held a series of mock trials a few years ago in which he brought together a jury, a judge, a prosecutor, witnesses, and brought out evidence. And they concluded in 3 out of 4 cases, he did 4 mock trials, that Marr was a victim of murder, of homicide. And I don't want to tell your listeners who did it, but you can see in the book that I lead that horse to water.
Timothy Egan lives in Seattle, Washington. Look for more information about him at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. You'll also find poems and children's book reviews there, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.